right, it appears that we have council present and we are ready to begin with the 3 o'clock argument. This is the afternoon session of the June panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is David Arterburn from Papillion, and I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Francie Reedman of Gretna and Chief Judge Frankie Moore of North Platte. And the case before the court at this time is State of Nebraska versus Federico Torres. And counsel, I would remind you that we are being live streamed. So if there's any sensitive information, you should keep that in mind as you present your arguments. So I believe it's Jaeger?
It's Jaeger, Judge.
Jaeger, okay. So, sir, you can begin your argument.
May it please the court. My name is Jared Jaeger. I represent Federico Torres in this appeal. This is a criminal appeal. The main issue here is, or our contention is, that the state's failure to submit evidence was created. I'm sorry. This case involves the state's failure to submit evidence sufficient to establish excludable time for purposes of speedy trial. There were two periods discussed in briefs. However, the one period of that I'm going to concentrate on with my argument today is between October 25th of 2017 and February 28th of 2019. The state's objection to the motion for absolute discharge relies on establishing that this period was excludable based upon the defendant's unavailability. However, prior case law, including State v. Richter, State v. Beck, and State v. Groves, all hold that the state must prove notice. That's where the state's offer of evidence in this case fails. The state's only evidence submitted is what each of the parties has termed Exhibit 3. That's what it was known as at the trial court level, and that's how I will refer to it in my argument. It was headed notice, and it contains, I believe, all the information that the state would rely on in support of its objection. We have an interesting situation here where both the county court and the district court ruled in favor of the state. However, they did so in two different and inconsistent reasons. The county court started off its rulings by indicating that it properly pointed out that notice was the issue, and then the county court specifically stated that neither party had provided information as to procedurally how that notice is in fact sent, where it's sent, and who sends it. I think that's the point where the county court's ruling diverged from established law, and where the error is created for the county courts on the county court's part. First of all, the county court felt that mailing by U.S. mail is sufficient to provide notice. I believe that State v. Richter's specifically finds that that's insufficient. The next thing the county court did was it did something it termed as taking judicial notice of its own rules. It found that it knew how the county clerk would handle that notice document and believed that it would be mailed to the defendant. I think at that point the county court created a due process problem because it was referring to rules that we are not aware of. They're not published rules. And I can see where the county court had a difficulty there. The state had failed to provide evidence or bring in a witness that could testify to how that document is handled. nevertheless, we argue that there is no, there would have been no ability for the county court to have found that a mailed notice was sufficient to prove up unavailability.
So there's some reference in the Bill of Exceptions to the district court where the representation is made that the bailiff actually testified at the county court. Is that inaccurate?
I think you caught me. And here's why. At the time I was arguing this case, I was arguing three different speedy trial appeals coming out of that court. And in one of those cases, the county court bailiff had testified. But in this case, the county court bailiff did not testify.
Okay.
So there was no context provided for for Exhibit 3.
Mr. Yeager, if I can jump in with a couple of questions. So it sounds to me like you're arguing two different points of lack of notice. The first is that there was never a citation issued, there was never a summons issued and served, and he wasn't your client wasn't arrested, and so there's an initial lack of notice that a proceeding even exists. Is that your first argument?
Yes, I believe that does present a problem.
Okay. And then the second part of it is that there just simply was no notice of this specific continued hearing date or for the arraignment.
That's where
maybe you're putting most of your eggs, I guess. But am I accurately ascertaining your arguments?
I think, absolutely. The second problem that's created by not providing notice of the October 25th hearing is what I believe invalidates the claim that there is excludable time from that date on. Now, there may have been an easier way of establishing that excludability if this case had begun through a citation or arrest. Because I think at that point, the court can probably impute some level of notice or an obligation on the part of the defendant. Although I don't know that this case necessarily needs to go down that line. I think it's as simple as there's insufficient notice of the October 25th court hearing. I think Groves speaks to that primarily. It stands for that proposition that a defendant can't be claimed to be unavailable for something for a hearing he has no notice of. Now, I want to get to the district court's error in this case, because I think the way the law is constructed now, I've got to basically prove that both the district court and county court erred. Now, the district court, the district court did not actually get into a Richter or Groves analysis. The district court apparently found that the appellant had actual notice. Although I'm a little bit lost because of the way the district court termed it. I think if you want to remember one thing about my argument, and it's this, there's no basis in the evidentiary record of the appellant having actual notice of his obligation to be in court on October 25th, 2017. The district court's explanation of Exhibit 3 as a form of notice was vague. It isn't clear whether the court meant in terms of mailed notice, as the county court did, which is legally insufficient, or actual notice, as in it was evidence that someone in an official capacity had told the appellant to be in court on October 25th, 2017. That conclusion, I think that conclusion would ignore the realities of that document itself. That document contains no specific statement of the defendant being told to be in court on a particular date. It's obviously not a document that's created pursuant to a hearing in which the defendant appeared.
Has by virtue of Exhibit 10 or otherwise, do you believe that you have conceded that your client did make that call to the clerk's office?
Well, I would have to concede that the district court's indication that a court has to deem a court document as true, I just have to concede that notion. But for instance, this notice doesn't indicate when that call was made. We don't even know for certain that it was made on September 26th, which is the date of the document. And I think that most people that have any contact with trial courts know that people can't simply call in and get a judge on the line and get a ruling on a motion over the phone. That's simply not the way it's done. I can't hardly believe that would be imputed to a defendant in this sort of situation.
Mr. Yeager, I know you're about out of time, but could you briefly address why you believe it was error for the county court to take judicial notice of its court clerk's procedures?
I believe that the county court is limited to the rules that are published and that it is under, or I guess. There's a due process problem. A litigant cannot come into court and have an understanding of what actions he's imputed to have or rules he's imputed to be followed or to have followed if it's not a published rule. The clerk that signed on this document is not necessarily the clerk that was in the courtroom on that day.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
One quick follow-up to that, too, Mr. Yeager, is the clerk that signed this, there's no indication that's the clerk magistrate either. Is that correct?
There's definitely not anything on the document that confirms that.
Okay. Is there any other record outside of this notice that shows a judge granting the continuance?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I don't think so, but I my guess is that the following journal entry where there was the failure to appear probably or may mention something about the prior continuance being granted, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
And you don't know if that's in our record?
I don't have that specific document in front of me.
Okay.
That journal entry in order would have to be in your record.
You think so? Okay. Thank you. All right. Osborne.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Nebraska. This is a statutory speedy trial case where the district court affirmed the county court's order overruling Torres's motion for absolute discharge. So I'll begin that this appeal, in this appeal, the judgment of the district court is what's reviewable by this court. Because it vacates the judgment of the county court. So we're only looking at Torres's assignments of error as they relate to the district court's order, not as to any assignments of error that relate to the county court's order. And the two main issues that relate to the excludable periods in calculating speedy trial are Torres's request for a continuance and his absence or unavailability from the court. The argument thus far has been focused on the absence or unavailability. I'll focus on that issue unless the court has any questions.
Oh, you're muted.
You're good.
Me. Unless the court has any questions about the continuance requested by Torres, I will move then to the absence or unavailability issue. So the arraignment in this case was scheduled for September 27th, 2017. And the day before the arraignment, so on the 26th, Torres called the county court and requested a continuance of that arraignment.
What evidence is there? What do we look at for that evidence that he called?
Well, I believe that there's both evidence in Exhibit 3 indicating that that Torres requested the continuance. There's also evidence in Exhibit 10, and I believe that the court also referenced it when Torres reappeared in court after his arrest. That wasn't an issue that was in dispute.
Ms. Osborne, with respect to Exhibit 10, and I realize that could be potentially an admission, but the court, that was offered by Mr. Yeager, and it was objected to by the state because they said it was argument. And the court said, well, I'm only going to accept it for purposes of argument. So if the court only accepted it for purposes of argument, can we accept it as substantive evidence?
Well, I believe that there's evidence regardless that the defendant called in and requested the continuance. The Exhibit 3 specifically says that the continuance was granted at the request of the defendant.
I'm looking at Exhibit 3. Is it more than one page?
I don't believe so.
All I see is a notice with the caption, the courts entered the following order in this case, hearing set for October 25th at 2 p.m. in Hall County Courtroom Number 1 for arraignment, date, special instructions, continued at defendant's request.
Correct. It was.
So we are saying he called in?
Well, that would be the only way for him to have requested it is to call because he's in Sioux City, Iowa, and he's calling to ask for the continuance so that he doesn't have to drive all the way to Grand Island, Nebraska.
How do we know all those things?
Well, I mean, regardless of whether he called in or whether he was physically present, he requested the continuance and it was granted. The new arraignment date was October 25th, which he failed to appear for.
So what in Exhibit 3 tells us he was informed of that date?
Well, the exhibit itself, based on the district court's ruling, and the district court talks about the contents of the order. So we have he requested the continuance. It was granted. It provides a new date, time, and location. The district court found Exhibit 3 was received into evidence with nothing to rebut its contents, and it could be presumed to be truthful. The order also shows that the county court staff verified Torres's current address in Sioux City, Iowa, and it is reasonable to infer for several reasons based on this evidence that the notice of hearing was sent to Torres. First, the order and notice of hearing was created for the purpose of notifying the parties. The only reason to verify Torres's current address is so that the court could send the order and notice of hearing to Torres at that address. We know that the order and notice of hearing was sent to the state because the state appeared at the October 25th hearing despite not having been present when the continuance was requested and granted.
What on Exhibit 3 says it was sent to the state?
The exhibit itself does not state that, but it's a reasonable inference that since the state appeared at the October 25th hearing, which you can tell because that hearing is in your record and the state is present, that it was provided to the state. They were not present when the defendant requested the continuance and when it was granted.
Well, if we're talking about reasonable inferences from Exhibit 3, is another reasonable inference then at the bottom of the exhibit that the notice was sent to Torres's Kearney address where he no longer resided?
Well, the only reason for the court staff to verify his current address in Sioux City, Iowa was so that they could send it to that address. We know that that address in Sioux City, Iowa is an accurate address, was correct for him, not only because it was provided by Torres when he requested the continuance, but it also came back in Exhibit 1. The returned envelope has the exact same address on it, and that was provided by the post office. So you have two separate pieces of evidence. One went to the county attorney's office, one went to the county court. One was provided to the county court that has the exact same address. So we know that the address is correct. And that the only reason that you would verify that address is so that you could send that notice of hearing and the order that contains a continuance to Torres at that address.
I might agree with that if the bottom address was consistent, but it's not.
Well, was there any certificate of service that actually shows where they sent the notice?
There's no certificate of service provided. It's not included. There's no certificate of service in the record. The county court made reasonable inferences, and the district court's order, which is what's being reviewed here, that's where the finding was made, that it is a reasonable inference, and a trier of fact can make reasonable inferences from the evidence. The county court was a trier of fact here. The district court found that it was reasonable inference for the county court to take the evidence in the record and find that the document was created for the purposes of disseminating it to both parties, that the state appeared at the hearing, so it received the document, and that it's also reasonable to infer that the only reason why they confirmed the current address is so that they could send it to Torres. And again, this particular issue is of notice, is an issue of fact. So the standard of review on appeal is a differential standard. Essentially, if the factual determination of the county court that notice of hearing was provided to Torres is supported by the record, essentially meaning, is it plausible based on the evidence in the record, then there's no clear error in the district court's judgment affirming the county court.
So are you telling us that the standard of or the burden of proof for the state was whether it's plausible as opposed to proving a preponderance of evidence?
Well, what I'm saying is the district court's review of the county court. So the county court has a preponderance of the evidence. The district court is reviewing the county court's findings for clear error.
But you just went over the district court's findings, and it's basically saying obviously affirming the county court, but it's basically adopting the rationale of the county court, is what you've just argued.
The district court is affirming the county court's determination that there is a preponderance of the evidence, and what's being reviewed here is the district court's judgment, and that's again being reviewed for clear error. So if the district court's judgment is supported by the record, then it is not clearly erroneous.
Okay, what was the district court's standard of review of the county court?
Clear error.
So we're applying the same, ultimately we're applying the same standard of review all the way back. Is that, in essence, I mean, we're reviewing
you're
the district
applying,
court
you're
agreed
applying.
With the county court, and then and the county court made its order. So we're basically looking at this whole situation for clear error. Is that right?
You're looking at the district court's judgment for clear error.
Okay.
I'm running out of time here. If there are any questions about the argument from defendant or from the appellant about the notice requirement, the state disagrees with their application of the notice requirement. Richter does not stand for the proposition that a notice of hearing, just a notice of hearing, not a citation, must be served by the requirements of citation that are included in Nebraska Revised Statute 29.425. That is not what Richter stands for. A notice of hearing does not have to be sent out by personal service, residential service, or citation, or by certified mail.
Let's accepting for the moment that Mr. Torres did call in and ask for the continuance. If you take that away, then there would be no notice of any kind. Is that correct?
Well, the issue at that point would be whether the letter that had been sent out was sufficient notice.
Is the letter sufficient under the statute?
Well, I mean, that would be up for the county court to make a factual finding. I don't know that it necessarily is, but that's not the issue in this case.
You're arguing that the call or whatever it was, the communication by Mr. Torres relieve the state of any burden with respect to issuing a citation, summons, or arrest?
Yes, the request for continuance obviously shows that Torres already knew about the charges, so the issue of citation is moot at that point.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right. I think we went over with everybody today, so the case will be submitted. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments, and we'll issue a decision when we can. You are excused.
Thank you both.